everybody. Hello. Welcome to the Recovery Podcast. My name is Tim Roberto, and I am your host. I have a wonderful guest here today, Dr. Phil Bellone. Dr. Phil Bellone and I have known each other, about 10 years now.
At least 10 years, yeah.
We met at least 10 years ago, and, you know, fate, I guess, or just that force has us keep running into each other. We see each other out in the community, and then Dr. Phil came to my mind recently about the podcast, and boy, what a great guest he would be, and I'll let him tell you over the course of this podcast why I think he's a great guest, and I think you'll think the same as I do. So with that being said, Dr. Phil, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me this morning. Appreciate that.
Yep, it's wonderful to have you. So you're, I find, a fascinating fellow because, you know, this podcast is the Recovery Podcast. So it's always about struggle. It's always about mental health. It's always about PTSD. It's always about alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, form or discussion about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as soon as Doc got in the car today, because he's such a doer, he called me this morning. Had a flat tire, had him all morning, so I went and picked him up. But it didn't surprise me at all, and it gave me a little chuckle, actually. This is the latest book that he's written, and I think this is, what, your third or fourth now?
It's about my eighth.
Well, see, I'm behind. And he's just a fascinating guy, introduce yourself to everybody, and what's the journey been for you?
Well, the journey started 78 years ago. In St. Francis Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, and grew up in an area called Red Hook. Went to Catholic grammar school, public high school. Right after I graduated, I enlisted in the United States Army and joined the paratroopers. Served with Special Forces for a year and a half, and then I was shipped out to Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division.
Thank you.
And came back. And when I came back, I bounced around a few little jobs here and there. And then I decided I was going to take the police exam for New York City Police Department, which I did. Unfortunately, it was the Mayor Lindsay freeze time, so I had to wait a year and a half before I actually got appointed. I went on in 1973. And my whole career was in law enforcement was about 27 years in law enforcement. Saw a lot of drugs. I worked in a drug unit up in Harlem in the Manhattan North Narcotics Division, and it was pretty interesting, needless to say. Learned a lot about drugs, learned a lot about addiction, So it came a time in 1990, I had moved down here, and I worked those 10 years, and in 1999, I decided to get back into doing some public speaking about substance abuse, which I had done both as a police officer in New York and as a civilian in New York. I did a lot of schools, talked to parents about parenting and things like that. And my career in substance abuse and PTSD was ended in 2000, I want to say 2000 and maybe 12 or 13, after 22 years in that field. I still miss it. Mm. I do a lot of writing on addiction and on treatment. I have several philosophies. I use several modalities when I work in the field. And that's pretty much me.
Yeah, amazing, right? And that's just, you know, like the skim or the top of this career. When you came back from NAM, and you said you bounced around a little bit, was that for your own mental health? Was that for your own grounding? Like, did you need to get centered? Was that just part of your landing, coming back in from a combat environment?
Well, I don't know. I grew up in a family that everybody worked hard, and you worked. So when I got back, rather than sit there and think about what I had just left, because it was funny, I got discharged on, I left Vietnam on July the 2nd, 1968, and was home at a party on the 4th of July, 1968. And that transition was a little rough. You know, you're going from the jungles of Vietnam to the beaches of Long Island. And it took a while to adjust, but I wanted to go back to work, so I didn't sit around and start thinking about the stuff I had just left. And that's what I did. I went to work and bounced from job to job. I was a restaurant manager for a couple of years. Well, and all I say, and I even tell this to my clients, no matter how many jobs you had, no matter how long you had them for, you always learn something. Every job is a learning experience that you're going to use somewhere. So my restaurant experience made me into a pretty decent cook. So,
well, I'm sure you have to fill in every once in a while, huh?
In the restaurant. Once in a while. Yes, yes.
What's your favorite? What's your best dish?
Oh, I cook them. Well, being Italian, I cook mostly Italian dishes. Yeah. So any of my Italian dishes are good.
That's awesome.
I make a nice prosciutto and a white cream sauce put over the fettuccine.
Pretty good. Oh, that sounds, yeah, that sounds yum. So anybody, police officer in the family, or what kind of, you know, you like the excitement, the zero, you know, the...
Well, going into the police department, in all honesty, was I wanted a career, a civil service career job. I knew that if you worked 20 years with the police department, you'd end up getting a pension.
Yeah.
It also was a helping type of job. In the Army, I worked where I was the bodyguard for a chaplain. So we were out in the field all the time, and as he was blessing them, the wounded, and saying the giving the last rites for the dead, I would have to watch his back, and a couple of times I had to really watch his back.
Yeah.
And a lot of bad memories from there, too. Yeah. So I have a combination of, I went through PTSD, combination of Vietnam experiences and the police department experiences.
Yeah.
And to me, the only way you're going to get through a lot of this is you got to talk this stuff out. You got to. I like doing the writing part because you write your experiences down. And the first week, it's a 5-week program that I use.
Is this a program you came up with, Doc?
No, it's a program that's used in therapy. But I like it.
Gotcha.
I like it because you get to put down. Your first session is you just put down what best you remember the incident. The second session is you rewrite the first section, but now you start to write about what you felt during every step of the incident. And by the fifth exercise, you pretty much now have the coping skills that when you get these thoughts and memories, you can get rid of them. I left Vietnam, I told you, on July 2nd, 1968, and I still get at least 2 or 3 times a week intense dreams about Vietnam. That's over 50 years ago. So is it going to leave you? I don't think it leaves you. You need to learn how to cope with these.
Kind of stay in it, right? Stay in it, embrace it in a way, right? Take it on.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to run away?
No, there's no running away from it.
Correct.
It's only going to come back again.
Correct.
And again.
That's the illusion, right?
Right. And there are a lot of symptoms with it. So if you see yourself, you know, having trouble sleeping, if you tend to go to restaurants and want to sit where you're seeing the door, there's so many things that people that have PTSD do that they don't even realize that they do it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
So automatic.
Somebody coming up to you from behind. That's a big one for me. I don't like anyone coming up behind me.
Yeah.
Still, till this day.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's
yeah.
both from Vietnam and from being a yeah. police officer also.
Yeah.
So those are some of the things that PTSD does. What I did learn working at a center in Lake Worth, I did the first responders, and found that a lot of first responders just don't want to talk about their experiences. You know, we all have big egos when you're a police officer. Mm. You know, you're the man, you have control of everything. Mm. But really, I was telling Tim on the way over that every time I used to get a job that said man with a gun in a building or an apartment, and I'm running into the building and everyone else is running out of the building, I was scared. Now, a lot of cops will say, no, you know, my adrenaline's going. I want, but you're scared. You're scared because this could be the last door you go through.
Mm.
So there's a lot of experiences as a police officer that give you a lot of stress. Most police officers will not take home what happened during the tour. What we used to do after a 4 to 12 is we go to the neighborhood gin mill.
Yep.
Everybody go there. Now, cops would talk with other cops about what they experienced that shift, but then they would leave it there and go home and still thinking about this, and a lot of anger builds up in them. And most of the time, unfortunately, a lot of the anger and yelling and screaming and cursing is directed at the family because there's nobody else there but the family.
Mm.
So,
is that a common characteristic or a result? You know, of the profession, of the job?
I would say for most of the guys that I worked with and knew, yes, I would definitely say so. Does it affect everybody the same way? Probably not.
Yeah.
But for guys that have issues with any of the symptoms of PTSD, and I'm sure if you go to a class or a group with Tim, they'll go over all those symptoms. If you see you have two or three of them, it might be okay to sit down and talk with a counselor.
Dr. Phil, every time we get together, we always have these good conversations. We catch up, and on the way over to the studio, we were talking. And any thoughts on like that? Why it's such a strange mental blank spot? Like you said, you're going in when everybody's running out, but when it comes time for me to make a phone call, or when somebody actually asks me that question, how are you? It's just either the phone is 1,000 pounds or I'm good and fine.
Right.
So hard for us, like, to make ourselves vulnerable? Do you have anything specific on that? Or
specific is,
or just a general, like, you know, like you said, I'll say it again, right? You're running where everybody's run out. But when it comes to me, it's the hardest thing to do, is to say I need help. I'm not doing well. Or call for the phone. Any thoughts? Any philosophies on that?
Well, the thought is easy to talk about. It's easy to talk about things other than what you personally did as a police officer.
Mm.
It's hard to talk about it.
Is it because nobody understands me, or? You know, you don't know what I go through, if you went through what I went through. But, like, even cop to cop, it's like, fine, good.
Well, cop to cop in therapy, when I was working in therapy.
For you, 100.
It was pretty easy for me
to
get information from other cops.
Because
there was the issue in any kind of addiction program is first the addict, or the person suffering from PTSD, has to gain trust in the person they're going to talk with. If they don't feel you're at the same length with them, if you're not equal with them, they're not going to talk. So it's hard for most cops to talk to a non-first responder therapist and share all the inner feelings, because then they look like they're a crybaby.
Gotcha.
Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But that's part of the programming, I guess, right?
Yeah, because
the culture.
When you're in the academy, you know, they train you that you know, you're the man, you make the decisions, and you have to make split-second decisions. Yeah. And all of that is true. All of that is true.
Yeah, yeah.
And then sometimes after making a split-second decision, then you're thinking, well, did I make the right decision? Mm. And sometimes that plays on your brain for a long time. You know, I've been in shooting.
Especially if it's tragic outcome, right?
I've been in shooting incidents where one of the bad guys was a fatal shooting.
Yeah.
And I still think about that. And that happened in 1981 or 82.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, once in a while it pops in my head, you know. Yeah. Did I really have to do it? You know, not, even though he turned out to be a serial rapist. But you still have those thoughts. You know, raise the Catholic, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah. I got you. All that conflict.
Yeah, there's a lot of conflict.
Yeah,
yes.
Geez, what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought. So it's just, it's the over and over and over and over and over. 0 to 100, 0 to 100, 0 to 100, 0 to 100. And then the conflict. So you're just getting bombarded.
You're getting bombarded. And then with the over and over, what happens is some guys get very complacent. So they go to a job that they've been to several times. Mm. Let's just say, for example, domestic violence.
Yeah.
Well, you know, usually when I went to domestic violence, I would have my hand on my gun or the gun out of the holster on the side, because one of the top ways cops die is when they respond to domestic violence.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't think about that.
Yeah.
So you always got to be on the ready, you know. Yeah. So you're sitting in the car laughing and joking, talking about the ball game last night, having a cup of coffee, and then the call comes over, you know, man with a gun or husband stabbing his wife.
Mm.
And you get to the scene and you're going from that low point of being pretty relaxed.
Yeah.
And now the adrenaline is running, the heart is pumping, the sweat is coming down your brow. It's just hard sometimes for people to deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's very understandable, you know. Is there any, it's like, I think police officers, veterans, first responders, I think they're wired to do what we do. Like, we're just wired to do that, even though we talk about all this intensity, this trauma, the body changing. I think the body changes, genetically, too, your genes start doing something else other than they were designed for, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to keep going back, to keep going back. And a lot of us struggle, with families, right? Like we were saying before, the divorce rate's high. With first responders, police officers, veterans, anybody in an active position like that, you know. But it's this, we just use the word conflict, right? Even though I'm going through all this, I still show up every day for it.
Yes.
That's what I'm getting at. I'm wired to do what I'm doing.
And after doing law enforcement for over 25 years, I still miss it. Now, you asked earlier if anyone in the family was a police officer. Well, right after 9/11, my son John, my youngest son, who was doing fine down here in Florida, decided to go back to New York and take the test for the NYPD.
Oh, wow.
And he just finished his 20 years about a year ago.
Oh, wow.
So, he was assigned for a long time to the DEA as a liaison with the police department.
Yep.
So my wife always says, how come John doesn't tell you stories? I said, because it was a different time. In the 70s, it was a different time.
Yeah.
It was all that crack and all that heroin. When I first went to narcotics, it was heroin. And then I'll never forget standing on 125th Street in Harlem. It had just rained. And I'm standing by the curb getting ready to cross the street to go into my car. And I see these little vials coming down in the water. They were tiny little things, and they had blue caps on them. They had red caps on them. They had green caps, yellow caps, and I really didn't know what they were. So I picked one or two of them up, and I walked behind me where guys were selling drugs, even with the cops standing right there. And I asked them. I had to get some education. And I asked him, I said, what are these things now? I said, I've never seen them. He said, oh, that's the new drug. That's crack. That's where crack comes in.
Yeah.
You know, there was no crack in them, but
yeah.
I guess they open it, they do the crack, and they throw it in the street.
Yeah.
But that was my time, you know.
Yeah, Koch, Mayor Koch. I remember when Koch was in there, and hearts when that stuff first hit the street, right? Wasn't there people's hearts were just
people having heart attacks.
Heart attacks, like crazy.
Because then later on, what happened was they added into the crack. They started adding heroin. The China White came out, and the drugs really got bad.
Yeah.
But you know, my experience working 22 years in the field is that a drug addict doesn't think of that. He just thinks of the high.
His
life is, I got to get high.
Yep.
You know, if he's got no money in his pocket when he wakes up, he'll find money to have that $200-$300 a day habit fulfilled. He will do that. You know, he'll go out and beg and do steal or whatever he has to do.
Yeah.
They need that drug to survive.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I think the drug addict is like the only person I know that can leave the house with no money and get high for a week.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. The resilience and like how resourceful. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you as a therapist, me as a counselor, it's like our goal, right? Like, how do I get this guy or this gal to make that shift to put all that energy and all that time and discipline into recovery or improving the quality of their life?
Well, I think if they're in good recovery, and I worked the last place I worked for, I thought was a very good place.
Yeah.
I don't want to mention the name, but it was a very good place.
Yeah.
But anyway, it focused on the individual and the individual's problem. And what I loved about working there was the family was very involved.
Yeah.
So maybe every other session, and we probably did two or three sessions, individual sessions a week. One of those sessions would definitely be talking with the family.
Yeah.
And now that you have Skype, it actually gets the family on the computer screen. And that was a big help.
Oh, yeah.
Big help.
Because it's a family illness.
It's a family illness. It's a family disease.
Everybody gets to play.
And,
right?
And with and as far as the parents, for the first time now, can actually tell the addict how they feel.
Yeah.
What they're doing, what she is doing to them. And was a good program, and it worked out well.
Yeah.
In fact, I was telling Tim on the way over here, I still get phone calls from ex-clients.
Yep.
I get baby pictures. I get Christmas cards.
Yeah.
So, you know, so now I know these people have been clean for, years.
But you got a role in that too, Doc. You're very good at what you do, and you care, and you're... You know, you're just very unique, and I think that's what it takes too for a therapist or a counselor in this space, anyway, to be effective. Mm-hmm. You know, you have. I don't think it's as much whether you're in recovery or not. I think that's, I don't know. It's because everybody's got worth, but some people just have a very a unique gift. You know, and it's about communicating. It's about reaching, right? The addict, like they never, so many feel like they've never been heard or they've been invisible their whole life. Like, and then all of a sudden, here's this guy. Like, this guy really cares about me.
Yes.
You know, and he's really dropping some nuggets, some pearls, you know, to get me to start thinking. Because for me, you know, physically, I think the addict's screwed until the day they die. Just by how their bodies respond once it goes in, screwed, right? Because they got that phenomenon of crave. But I think the addict's gift, though, with people like yourself and me and people that help, the addict gets to change their thinking because it's their thinking that keeps putting it in, nothing else.
Yes.
And that is very intriguing to me. Kind of like fascinating in a way. Like, so here's a person that has a fatal progressive illness, just like blood disease or cancer or liver, you know, whatever, other fatal. But for some strange reason, they get to change their thinking. So they don't put in. Like, I wish I could tell that to a little girl down, the little girl's parents down at the Children's Hospital or something in Miami. That's, you know, I'm sorry, we've done all we could. And there's not much more. Well, I'll just change her thinking, you know. So that's what I'm getting at. For me, very intriguing, an addict has a fatal progressive illness, but for some reason they get to change their thinking. I find that one of those strange mental blank spots, like, interesting. So it doesn't surprise me that you get all that. And with all the, you know, life experiences you have and through your education up to your doctorate's degree, It really is true, too, like when they say, you know, the body keeps score, right? Like with the trauma, the body keeps score, mm-hmm. you know? Some people get activated. I'm not a big trigger guy. The word trigger, I like activated, right? The, from smells or like you were saying, yes. you know, I got to look at the door. Or I don't like people coming up behind me. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. There's all these things, but they're manageable.
Yep.
Do you are you a big fan of EMDR?
Questionable.
Okay. What would you say is, what's your, do you have a go-to to start breaking somebody down, for lack of a better word? Or, you know, like, how do you put your, because you were a street cop.
Right.
And you got promoted to detective, right? Yep. So between those two points, in, is the, do you have a way to kind of figure something out? Like, pick, okay, I'm going to pick this apart, and then I'm going to help him put it back together. Like.
Well, I usually start with going back to when they were a child. I think a lot of this has to do with what happened to them as a child. I think a lot of clients that I worked with, especially male clients, it was easy to get a female client to talk about sexuality mm. when she was growing up, her mm. uncle, her grandfather, whatever. But it is tough to get that out of a guy.
Sexual abuse?
Sexual abuse, right.
But from what I've read, about one in six boys are sexually abused.
Sexually abused, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And girls, I think, from what I've read, some say one out of three, some one out of four.
Yes, it's much higher with the females.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to look at where you work.
Yeah.
You said, I think you told me you have like 175 beds or...
75
each way.
Yeah.
I apologize.
No, you're good.
75. So if it's one and one out of six boys, how many boys in there have been sexually abused and how many are willing to talk to them? So what I do is I tell them right from the beginning, I'm going to be honest with you.
That you're honesty, very good at. You're very good.
Honesty is the best policy. And some schools of thought is counselors shouldn't share their own personal experiences. Mm. I think that's BS to tell you the truth.
Me too.
I want to tell you like it is. You know, this is what happened to me.
Yep.
This is how I handled it. This is how I lived with it for so many years until I actually told somebody.
Mm.
And there were some things that happened to me as a kid that I would never talk to anyone. And then when I worked in my first social work job in Long Island after retiring, I went to lunch with this girl. And it was Gilda. I actually remember her name. And just during lunch, we were talking about a client, and all of a sudden I said, that happened to me. And she goes, what do you mean that happened to
you? Wow.
And I just poured everything out. And I felt so much better because I got it off my chest.
But why is that, though? Like, are human beings wired to connect? Or are we wired to feel? And then we go against the grain? Like, we shove it down. We implode. And you know, so when we do get honest and do get it out, why is that always a guarantee? Like, I'm just going to feel better. Is it part of just honor, like, because we're honoring our authentic self, you know, we're not protecting it, we're not attaching any shame or guilt to it. Like, it always just feels better, but it's the hardest thing to do.
It's the hardest thing to do. but once you do it, you do feel better because you got this block that was on your back and finally taken away.
But what taught us to attach shame to it?
Oh.
Because, you know, I won't say anything. Like, what do you think about that? Is there, like, why do we feel it's wrong or, you know, I don't tell anybody? Or how does that happen?
Because of embarrassment, maybe. I don't know. Could be embarrassment.
It's deep, though, right? When you think about it, like, I'm a 6-year-old boy. Something happens to me. And just instinctually, I'm like, so there must be something wrong with me or I'm not saying anything.
Well,
like,
I think that's what it is, you know, especially when it comes to sexual incidents,
you know,
boys don't do that.
Yeah.
Or I'm embarrassed. I don't want to tell anybody.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side of that, I've had clients that actually were abused and went to their parents and told them, and the parents turn around and tell them, oh, come on, that's not what he meant.
Shoot it down.
They shoot it down, and then you think the kid's going to go back and talk to them next week? Not going to happen.
No, you crippled them even more, right?
Yeah, and I found that to happen often.
Yeah.
So it's all in the therapist's technique. You know, I think that's got a lot to do with it.
Do you have a favorite technique? Favorite, you know, that you really enjoy, that you just, man, this is just my jam. You know, are you a CBT guy? Or are you?
I like CBT.
Yeah.
I like CBT a lot.
Yeah.
I like the written exposure therapy a lot. Those two are my favorites.
Yeah.
I use a lot of it. Kind of mix them together.
Yeah.
Because that's what it works better.
Yeah.
That writing, the written exposure is that second session where you rewrite it, and now you talk about your feelings. That jumps right into cognitive behavior therapy.
And a sprinkle of honesty.
Yeah.
All right.
So it's there, you know. And so I like using those two models.
I look at writing as, because most of us won't do it. We choose to stay up here all the time. Is getting outmaneuvered. But when you can get people to write, this is how I look at it. I don't know, maybe you have something else you want to add to. Like when I get people to write, it's just write. Well, what do you want me to write? Doesn't matter. Just start writing, and the flow will start.
Right.
And I'm not going to try to put that on a blackboard and explain that to you. We'll just start. But I want to read it together with you, right? Because when you read what you wrote, it just comes back differently, doesn't it? Then doing this all the time instead of journaling or writing. Like, do you find that kind of the same? Are we on the same page?
Absolutely.
As that?
And that second session of that writing exercise is where now you talk about them, rewrite it.
Mm-hmm.
But now as you rewrite it, tell me when that incident happened, what were you feeling? What was going on in that head of yours, you know?
Yeah.
And be honest, because after we're finished with this paper, you know what you're going to do? You can rip it up in 20 million pieces and throw it away.
Yeah.
So nobody but you and I,
and
I can't break confidentiality, otherwise I lose everything.
Correct.
So,
and
most of them will do it. There are some that just outright refuse to write.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't know how to spell. I don't know. And when I start the session, I tell them, don't worry about spelling. Don't worry about punctuation.
Yeah.
Don't worry about any of that. Forget you went to school.
Yeah.
Just write.
Yeah. And be honest.
And be honest. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, street cop, beat cop, promoter, detective. What made you go into master's and then your doctorates?
Well, first, in to be a therapist, you need to have certain credentials.
So you knew, coming out of the gate, this is where I want to end up.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I,
you banged it.
I got my doctorate through a Christian university, and so I use a lot of religion sometimes in my therapy.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how many people don't want to talk about it, but once you get them started, they don't shut up.
Well, it's a touchy subject. There's
sure.
a lot of people mad at God and that kind of stuff. And so I say it's just a word, right? It's just like you go into the pizza shop and say, you know, I'll take a slice of pizza. I mean, if they called it a different word 3,000 years ago, you'd be calling it that different
word. That word, correct.
So, you know, maybe, you know, it's like the acronyms, you know, good orderly direction.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an alcoholic, group of drunks. You know, and then I stumbled upon this because I, you know, as a sponsor too, right? My own personal life, I sponsor a lot of men too, and I run up against that a lot. And so one day it came to me, you know, I would say to them, "Let me ask you this question, because you got to be open, you got to be willing, you got to have an open mind. Recovery is all about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. It just is." So I discovered it years ago. I said, "Let me ask you something." Are you pissed at God, or are you pissed at the people in the church? Because what I read in Scripture is not what I see people.
Exactly.
And that has turned a lot of light bulbs on.
Oh, yeah.
And it's broken down. It's taken away that resistance a little bit more, and that's all we need, right? Just a little. And it's amazing how well that works, and I still use it today. I still run into it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you take a great writing, like as a writer yourself, 8 books, not just I think I said 4 or 3. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes.
And it specifically states in that book, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So you get your master's, you get your doctorate's degree, Christian counseling, Yeah. Is that right?
Christian counseling is very important as part of the overall counseling.
Correct.
You've got to have that piece in there.
Correct.
You have to have that piece.
Does it have to be Christian? Can it be spirituality? Can it be Jewish? Like just,
I tell them it's just spirituality.
Spirituality. Yeah, because, as long as there's some practice of, like getting centered or listening to different things, right? Spending quiet time. Because the body needs that side of it too, right?
Yep.
I know from my experience, they've tried everything else. They've tried everything. They've been trying to get outside of self for years.
Right. But, yeah, you're right. They need to find themselves. You know, I look at the first step. I tell my groups when I do groups, especially when we're doing 12-step groups, I tell them, of all the steps, the first step is the hardest one. Because you didn't accept the fact that you're an alcoholic, that you're a drug addict, that you're an anger person. You got to accept that first step.
Mm.
And you want to know something? Probably none of you in this room right now ever accepted it because you're back here for your second, your third, your fourth time. Keep coming back. Keep coming back.
Yeah.
But you got to accept the fact that you're an addict. Once you do that, you move to the second part of the first step. And that, then when you accept all that, and, you know, I love people, and I get excited when I say this. I love people when they go and they come to group and they go, well, I did the 12 steps. And I ask them, okay, now they're back in recovery.
Mm.
And, well, when did you do them?
Mm.
Oh, I did them in the last program I was in, okay. And how long were you in that program?
Mm.
Oh, 30 days. So you're telling me you did the 12 steps in 30 days. I said, there were people that are working on their second step, and they've been in the program for 5 years.
Mm.
It takes time.
Mm.
And when you do the steps, you've got to complete each step before moving to the next one.
1 through 12 for a reason.
That's right. That's right.
1 through 12 for a reason.
And if you do it, it works.
100%.
But you got to accept that first step. That's
correct.
The big, to me, that's the giant step.
Without it, you can't go to 2.
No, you can't go anywhere.
But that's the crazy thing about, you know, mental health, drug addiction, alcoholism, right? It's like, it's the only illness I know that tells me I don't have a problem.
Right.
Like you said, the repeat offenders, you know, in treatment 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, still fighting, still resisting. And you just ask them a question, something like on that line, you know, like, well, why are you back?
Right.
And then my classic is, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean you don't know? You know everything else.
Right.
You know how to go to YouTube to look up a video, how to fix a light switch. You know, but you don't argue with that. You don't have an argument with the guy doing the YouTube video. Don't stand up out of your seat. Oh, you're bull of crap. You don't know. You don't do anything like that. Oh, okay. And you don't even know this person.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling this guy or this guy your deep, dark secret. You know, or some of your secrets, but you're still debating. You still want to play ping pong.
Right.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Absolutely crazy. It's a crazy disease.
Yeah. So you've written 8 books.
Mm-hmm.
What
some novels, some on treatment. Yeah.
Is this your first book on trauma?
Well, actually, that book is a workbook. It's a condensed version of a much larger book that I had. It's an easy read, and if you do all the exercises in it, then you'll realize.
Yeah.
That, you know, do I have a problem? Do I not have a problem? And the goal of the workbook is that at the end, if all these little things helped you that I give you to do, then perhaps maybe you should go see a therapist and do this in person.
So you're sharing, you know, what worked for you.
Yeah.
Pretty much, right?
I tell you in the beginning chapter, I talk about my own personal PTSD, you know.
Yeah.
PTSD growing up.
Yep.
PTSD in the military,
yep.
And PTSD in the police department.
Mm.
And sometimes now PTSD in regular life.
It can come, right?
Generalize,
it's all
course.
It's in all forms, isn't mm-hmm. it? It comes mm-hmm. in all forms. Is there a specific, I don't know about form, like is there a common thread between it? Like trauma, is there a common thread? Is it, you know, would the common thread be like it's, you know, unfortunate experiences that altered like the course of my life, that changed my sails to a different direction, anything common? Or is it kind of just like things that have happened that normally you wouldn't do?
Things happen that normally you wouldn't do, and then when you do them, it kind of affects your brain, your thinking patterns. And that's where the PTSD, the nightmares come in and things like that. You know, especially if you've seen horrific things, which police, firemen, emergency medical technicians, I mean, these guys and gals that are out there, you know, they see a lot of crap. And what they want to do is just not take it home with them. They want to go to work, hang up their badge, and then go home. Mm. It doesn't work that way.
It just doesn't. Behind every uniform is a human.
Right. And then when you go to the academy, they kind of tell you, you know, even at the end of your 8-hour or 10-hour shift, you know, you're still a cop. So if you see something happening, you're supposed to take action, you know.
Yeah.
And then that plays on you too, you know.
Yeah.
If I didn't do that, I didn't even have to do that.
Yeah.
But now I did it, and now I'm in trouble because I did it. You know, maybe the guy made a complaint against me or something.
Yeah.
But you want to know if the same thing happened again tomorrow, you do it.
Yeah.
Because it's in you.
It's just the way it is,
You know.
Wired.
Yeah, well, it's like the alcoholic, you know. We can send him to treatment, and then he's tempted in a bar with friends because he's only drinking seltzer. How long before he tells the guy, throw a shot of Johnny Walker in there?
100%. Did you ever go down that course with all the situations you had? Did you ever get to the line where you're like, hey, either I got to stop with the drinking, or I'm gonna cross the line, or it just never got to you in that respect?
No, like when I came out of the military, I was a big drinker. Probably could have used the program. But like most drinkers say, I'm only a weekend drinker. I don't drive when I drink.
Yeah.
I call Uber.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But then when I started to see that it was affecting my thinking and just affecting my goal. I wasn't married at the time. My going out with my now who's my wife.
Yeah.
I just slowed down. I'll be honest with you. I didn't stop.
Yeah.
I still will have a drink occasionally if I go out with the guys for dinner or something.
Well, that's because you can, right? Like you said, a drink, not 15.
No.
Yeah.
And you know, another thing I found, as I'm getting older, the less I'm looking to have a party where I'm going to drink all night.
Yeah.
I'll have my drink, maybe two, and sitting down and having a conversation with people.
Yeah.
Or watching people make idiots of themselves.
That doesn't take much to see that.
No, it doesn't.
Especially if there's booze around.
Well, I'm talking about at a party with a lot of booze.
Oh, yeah. Get silly,
So that's an issue.
Yeah.
Just to jump back to that, the writing program. I learned a lot of that by reading stuff from the VA.
Mm.
VA gives you a lot of information online if you spend the time and go there, especially on drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And the writing assignment that I use, even though it's part of the theories with cognitive CBT and all those, I use the one that the military uses for women. Because many women are sexually abused in the military.
Yeah.
And they have a program for them. And they use this writing format.
Man.
And that's the kind of format that I use. Because it'll work for women, it'll work for men.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that are interchangeable,
right? Yeah, you can
interchange
it easily.
Abuse is abuse, man.
Yep.
So, so you obviously, how many years have you been married?
Okay. 55.
Wow.
55. I got married in 70.
Can I ask you how you guys met?
My grandmother had bought a property in Patchogue, Long Island, East Patchogue.
Uh-huh.
And my father-in-law had a property in East Patchogue.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, had the kids all hang around together for the summers.
Yeah.
And that's how we met.
Wow.
We actually met when we were 16. So if you add those years up into 20.
Holy cow. That's I think you said you were 78, right? I'm not putting you on. I'm not putting you on blast.
On spot,
no. So you were six. You were like 16, right? 14.
Yeah, 16.
16. Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah. But she did break up with me once.
Oh.
I got a Dear John letter in the Army when she found out I was extending my tour. I volunteered to stay six more months.
Oh, wow.
Because the priest that I was working with, he extended his tour. So I couldn't leave him alone.
No.
He needed a babysitter.
Boy, talk about commitment on both your parts.
Yeah.
Or all of your, right? Your wife, your commitment to the priest, and the priest's commitment to his comrades, his fallen brothers or injured brother. Wow. That's commitment.
Yeah.
Holy cow. So how many kids?
Two boys. Three grandchildren boys.
Three grandchildren.
We're hoping the oldest grandson has the girl.
Yeah. So life is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's doing well.
Good. Good. I love the shirt.
Well, thank you.
It's okay to ask for help.
That's for the policeman to realize.
Yeah.
It's all right to ask for help.
And if we did reach that guy, because that's always our goal. We were talking about it before. My goal, I know Dr. Phil's goal, Beachway's goal, anybody that's in this line of service, is our goal is to reach that one person that might have just stumbled upon it. I don't know. I'm not in the business of outcomes, just in the business of carrying the message and doing things like this. So if there was that one person, how could they get in touch with you?
They can go online and put in, they can write to me at counselor46@yahoo.com.
Counselor 46.
OR on the end. Counselor46@yahoo.com.
Thank you for doing that. And you know, if we did just happen to reach that one person, I've known Doc about 10 years, maybe a little longer.
Yeah.
I mean, ace, just. I don't know. They just don't make him like him anymore.
Thank you.
Very, very clever, gifted, serve. He's got a server's heart. He'll definitely tell you the truth.
Absolutely.
100%. I can vouch for that. And any last words before we wrap it up?
But like my shirt says, it's not. Ask for help if you need it. Mm. You'll know if you need it. Give it a shot. If you're sitting out there saying, maybe I should go to a meeting. I don't know if I should. Give it a shot. First of all, you're going to meet some good people there. Because good people go to meetings.
Mm.
And you'll learn something. And then if you think that you need help, which most of you probably don't think you need help, but if you think you need help, try going to a program. You know, Beachway seems to be one of the better programs. Give it a shot. You go in there, talk to a therapist, talk to an administration person, talk to someone, get some information, and then go for it. You can be straight again. There's no doubt in my mind. Anyone who's an alcoholic or a drug addict, you can be straight again. You can be a straight person and not use anymore. It's up to you. You're the one that's got to make the change in your life. Tim and I can't make the change in your life. We can give you suggestions. We give you recommendations. We give you direction.
Mm.
But you have to first say, I want help. I need help. Once you get through that, you get the ball rolling, you'll be okay.
Fantastic. So my name's Tim Roberto. I am also all over the place. My email is tim.r@beachway.com. I'm on social media. If for whatever reason you want to contact me to put you in touch with Dr. Phil, whatever you need, we can do the rest for you. So with that being said, thank you for coming, listening to another episode. We hope we've changed the conversation for you, and we'll catch you next time. Until then, I'm wishing you all peace and love.